Good afternoon. I'm Mike Nichols with NBAA. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. I think more folks might come in as we get the word out over in the hangar that this educational session is starting. And it's appropriate that we're having this talk today on enforcement actions and judges and things of that nature, because I just received a CNN breaking news announcement, and I know you all will care about this. A judge ordered Paris Hilton back to jail, CNN confirmed. She was taken from court screaming, the Associated Press reports. So I'm glad that things like that... I'm glad that things like that are such a high priority that CNN sends them out as breaking news. But in any case, we are going to talk today about crew resource management and the reasonable reliance defense with the FAA. And I'm pleased that we have Mr. Greg Winton with us today, who's an aviation attorney who worked for the FAA, representing the agency in enforcement hearings before the NTSB and the Department of Transportation administrative law judges, then later in litigation on wrongful death, personal injury, and property damage suits. He left the FAA to join the Department of Justice Aviation and Admiralty litigation, representing the United States in defensive lawsuits, and now is of counsel at the Washington, D.C. law firm of Yodis & Associates since 2002. He's an active member of the Lawyer Pilots Bar Association, the NTSB Bar Association, and the AOPA, and he's an instrument-rated commercial pilot who owns a Cessna 172 based out of Gaithersburg, Maryland. So, Greg, thank you for being here today. I look forward to your words.
Thank you, Dan BAA and Mike Nichols, for introducing me. It's a pleasure to be here. It's an honor to represent the association and educate its members on some of the latest breaking news as far as aviation law is concerned. I am the president and founder of Aviation Law Experts. After spending 10 years with the FAA and another 3 years with the Department of Justice, I worked with a lot of experts in the field, FAA aviation safety inspectors, NTSB investigators, and as they've all come to retire, and we all left the FAA and the NTSB, they now work with me as consultants. So we are a worldwide aviation law firm and consulting firm. So if any issues ever arise, we're able to answer them 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. The reason why I was asked to present here today is to discuss CRM. CRM, back in the day when I was at the FAA in the mid to late 80s, was known as cockpit resource management. It was something that was come up by the FAA and industry because I remember at the time, especially in the eastern region, I worked at the Kennedy JFK FAA office, US Air had a tremendous amount of altitude violations. We could not explain why, didn't understand why. And eventually what happened was, we said, well, the guys aren't working together. Now it's set the altitude, the second guy touches it, they both confirm altitude is set, the airplane goes and it levels off where it should. Well, after CRM, cockpit resource management, was implicated, was put into effect, all of these altitude busts started to decrease. So the FAA and the industry said, hey, great thing, let's take this and move with it. And they've run, and now recently we have two advisory circulars which talk about CRM, but it's no longer cockpit resource management. It's now crew resource management. And they've included flight attendants in the crew. They've included dispatchers in the crew. They've included air traffic controllers, all as part of the safety of coordinating a flight. So what I'm here to tell you today is if you have a corporate flight department, whether you're operating under Part 91, if you're operating under Part 135, you need to have certain standard operating procedures in effect, which will teach your pilots and your crew how to operate together in harmony so that we can have this crew resource management. More importantly, if you're operating on a Part 91, where you're not required to have a standard operating procedures, if something happens in the cockpit and there's a violation of the regulations, you want to be able to show the FAA that you have standard operating procedures in effect. And those advisory circulars have been published, AC-12071 and AC-12051. Without going into what they say and what they do, they're there as guidelines. You can really copy them, put them into a manual, hand them to your crew and say, this is how we will operate. Let's talk about the practical effect of once you have good crew resource management. Now, this is me. If you call me Gregory, I'll assume I did something wrong because my mother only called me that when I did something wrong. My name is Greg. This is for those who don't have an imagination. That's what I look like when I'm all dressed up. I've been able to convince many a judge that I've got a right position when I get dressed up like that. And when we talk about crew resource management, we talk about the overview, which I just touched on, but reasonable reliance defense. That's why we want CRM. I was given a call about a year and a half ago by Kent Jackson, another attorney who speaks frequently with NBAA, and he said, I've got this case. It's on the East Coast. That's where you're based, Greg. Can you handle it for me? I said, sure. Give me the facts of the case. He said, this is what happened. We've got a pilot in command and a second in command. They're flying a Learjet. The Learjet is type-rated for two pilots. Now, the biggest problem that I have in explaining to the FAA when I'm fighting one of these enforcement actions is the FAA, the people you work for, type-certificated this airplane for two pilots. He can't fly it by himself. You brought an action only against the pilot in command. Well, if something went wrong in a flight, two guys had to have done it wrong. Now, the pilot in command is always responsible for the safety of the flight. I understand that. So either you bring both of them in or you bring nobody in. So I said to the FAA, if it's a two-man operation, and you won't let us fly at single pilot, then each of those pilots must have a delegated assigned duty in that cockpit to make the flight run efficiently. And the lawyer on the other side who works for the FAA is not a pilot, has no aviation experience other than sitting as a passenger in a commercial jet, and can't get that through his head that, okay, if there's a delegated responsibility for the PIC and there's a delegated responsibility for the SIC, if that guy drops the ball, why are you holding the PIC responsible? The pilot in command doesn't have the time or the patience to follow up on everything that he assigns to his co-pilot. If he does, then he can't fly the plane himself. You do the navigation, I'll fly the plane. You do the radios, I'll fly the plane. If this guy screws up the radios, how can the pilot in command do his responsibility if he has to do both? So this is what happened. Around the D.C. area, which is where I'm based, we have since 9/11 the Air Defense Identification Zone, the ADIZ, A-D-I-Z. It screwed up everything. It was a knee-jerk reaction by Congress, Homeland Security, Transportation Safety Administration, FAA, Department of Defense. Let's put this big blue area on the chart and say, in order to fly inside the ADIZ, you must comply with this notice to airmen. Seven requirements. File a flight plan. Not a problem. Activate the flight plan. Two-way radio communications. Squawk a discrete transponder code. And three or four others. This Learjet was in York, Pennsylvania. They were going to Manassas, Virginia. In order to go from York, PA to Manassas, you must traverse through the Washington, D.C. ADIZ because Manassas is inside the defense zone. So they filed their IFR flight plan, and as they're coming into York, Pennsylvania, the same controller they're going to talk to on the way out says, I see here you have a flight plan to leave York also. You're going to depart in about 15 minutes. Call me on the ground. Here's the frequency. But keep in mind, York, Pennsylvania is surrounded by mountains. The repeater antenna that we have on the ground doesn't work real well on the ground. You might not be able to reach us on the radio when you're on the ground. Roger, they land, they get their passengers, or they drop the passengers off, get back in a plane, and they call on the radio. Can't get air traffic control on the ground, just like they were told. What do? Pick up the cell phone. Can't get through to them on the cell phone. There's no coverage in that area, New York, PA. So the captain says, this is what we'll do. We'll take off VFR, the weather was beautiful, and we're going to fly, and I'm going to fly the plane, and you're going to work the radios, and you're going to get us the clearance that we have filed with the FAA. Roger. Now, keep in mind, the captain was a junior to his first officer. He wasn't really a co-pilot. He was a co-captain, and he had twice as much flight time in the aircraft. They had flown together. The PIC knew this guy. He was comfortable with him and knew if he gave him a task, he would do it properly. So they take off out of York. They're staying below 10,000 feet. They're flying real fast, about 250 knots, and he says to his co-captain, make sure you talk to air traffic. He went through five frequencies. This guy turned him down on the clearance. We don't have time. Contact this frequency. Didn't have time. Contact this frequency. We can't help you. Contact another one. Finally, he got a controller who said, great, squawk 4321. And they proceed toward the Washington, D.C. ATIS. Now, the pilot in command is thinking, we have a squawk code. We had filed a flight plan. I see he's talking to air traffic control. Those are the requirements for flight into the air defense identification zone. The pilot in command was satisfied that his first officer did what he was supposed to do. And he went right into the ATIS. Just as they came up to the border, the controller said, remain clear of the ATIS. The guy in the right seat never told the pilot that. And they went right through it. So what happens? An enforcement action comes. 60-day suspension of the pilot's certificate. They didn't do anything about the first officer. When I read the FAA's enforcement file, I said, there's not even a statement here from the first officer. Nobody spoke to him. So I said, there's got to be some law on this. You can't hold a guy responsible who thought he was doing everything right. The reasonable reliance defense. It's one of those old law school things that you learn about that's never used. It's like the last-ditch effort. If the law's not on your side and the facts on your side, argue reasonable reliance. Maybe someone will buy it. Well, this law judge, the chief administrative law judge of the NTSB, bought my defense, and it worked. Now, I'll also talk about Equal Access to Justice Act, because under the EAJA, if you win against the FAA and you're able to prove that you weren't substantially justified in bringing the case in the first place, you can get attorney's fees granted. So in a case that everybody thought was a loser, we actually wound up with something pretty good. Now, talk about reasonable reliance. The case that everybody refers to when we talk about this, when we're talking about pilots, is Fay and Takax. Okay, the FAA came after a flight crew. In this case, it happened to be pilot in command and a flight navigator in a 727. The facts are completely different. They were at a New York airport. They throttled up and they knocked over two small airplanes without looking. The judge in that case said, well, you're blaming a flight engineer that he should have looked behind before he got in the plane, but you're the pilot. Before you throttled up, you should have also known. So in that case, no reasonable reliance. But I took this law and applied it the way it needed to be done. Is the particular task that was assigned by the pilot in command the responsibility of another? Well, in my case, the pilot was flying a plane VFR, 4 miles a minute over the ground below 10,000 feet. He said, Captain, in the right seat, your task is to get us an air traffic control clearance. Work the radios. Now, the good thing is, the chief judge of the NTSB said, not only is that the task that he was assigned, he was qualified and competent to take that task, and we had a standard operating procedure. It was a Part 91 flight, but this flight department had structure in place just like they were a Part 135 air charter service. It was wonderful. Big book called SOPs, and it says, pilot and command may delegate the responsibility to his co-pilot, in this case, work the radios. So I met that first burden in my reasonable reliance defense. Second one, does the pilot in command have an independent obligation or the ability to ascertain the information? That's what this means. In my case, the pilot in command gave the first officer the duties to handle the radios. Now keep in mind, like most Learjets, there's two radios. They both have a headset, and the FAA argued, well, your guy as the pilot in command is wearing a headset. He could hear everything that the first officer is saying to air traffic control on the radio. Not true. If my guy is on radio one and the other guy is on radio two, he's not going to hear the conversation with the air traffic controller. When I questioned the FAA inspector about that, he said, well, first of all, I'm not familiar with the Learjet that they were flying. Second of all, I didn't even know what kind of radios the Learjet had, and I didn't ask anybody what the configuration of the radios is. So the FAA inspector had no idea if they might have been on two different frequencies at the time that the first officer was told, remain clear of the ATIS. So the pilot in command didn't have an independent obligation to check everything that his senior captain was doing. More importantly, he had no ability to ascertain the information that they were not cleared inside the ATIS. He was on a different frequency. He didn't even know that they were told to stay outside. So I passed that test. Number three, the big one. Does the captain have a reason to question the other's performance? If that guy in the right seat was a junior to my captain, was a new guy on the job, was given this task for the first time, or if they hadn't flown together very much, then I might not have passed that. But in this case, the judge acknowledged, you got a senior captain. Sure, you give him that task. Any monkey could work the radios. The captain had no reason to question the ability of his first officer. You pass all three tests, you win. Reasonable reliance. You shouldn't have held the pilot in command responsible for flying the aircraft inside the ADIS. It was great. It was wonderful. So we won the case. Now, with regard to this defense, it's been used in other cases cited by the NTSB. And for those of you that don't know, when the FAA brings an enforcement action, and by enforcement action I mean suspension, revocation of a certificate, okay, you get an opportunity to appeal before an administrative law judge. That administrative law judge works for the National Transportation Safety Board. If that administrative law judge, after hearing an evidence, and it's just like a regular trial, but there's no jury, if he renders a decision and says, okay, suspension of the certificate, and the pilot doesn't like that answer, you can appeal once more to the five-member panel of the NTSB, the board members, the same board members that decide probable cause findings on air crashes. Now, the crazy thing is, you argue the facts before the judge. The judge knows the law. I argue the facts before the judge. If I lose before the judge, I appeal to the NTSB. They're not lawyers. I argue the law before the NTSB. So I should be arguing the facts to the NTSB and the law to the judge, but the FAA doesn't allow it to happen that way. It's a backward system. If I lose before the NTSB, I get one more shot up to the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, which is a real judge appointed by life by the president, and then we can go to the Supreme Court. So this other case, the administrator versus Bass, again, different set of facts, but in that case they said, did the PIC have any reason or basis to question either the other individual's representation or performance of assigned duties? In that case, pilot in command, first officer was supposed to check the equipment. If anything was broken in the airplane, check it against the minimum equipment list. If the aircraft equipment that was malfunctioning is under the minimum equipment list, they could still take off because the aircraft is considered airworthy. Well, the first officer dropped the ball, and he didn't find out if this piece of equipment was on the minimum equipment list, and the captain took off anyway. In that case, the judge said, pilot in command can rely on his first officer in this situation. You got to give him a pass. And the specific language that they used is that the pilot in command is not culpable for a violation of the regulations, which is caused by the action, or in this case, inaction, of another person. When the PIC had no reason or basis to look beyond or question the other individual's representation. So that's great case law right there. And we use that whenever we can. Now, in my particular case, even though we won, and even though the judge granted us fees, attorney's fees on top of it, which is like insult to injury to the FAA, the FAA did not appeal the decision of the judge. They said, all right, Winton, you won. We're going to let the pilot walk away with no suspension. What they did appeal was a decision for the judge to grant us the money that they gave us back. And in the decision, they not only gave the money back to the FAA and said, you don't get a penny, which is unfortunate, but they almost went beyond that and said, you shouldn't have won the case to begin with, even though we won. And the question wasn't even before the NTSB. So this is the kind of craziness that we have to deal with as aviation attorneys when dealing with the NTSB and the FAA. So you may win, but on the other hand, they may take it back on an appeal. It happens quite often. Okay, Equal Access to Justice Act. Congress put this in effect because when the FAA brings a case, and they just had no basis in bringing it, you should get your fees back. Now, keep in mind, the fees are limited. If you have a $300 an hour lawyer, you only get now, I think it's $154 an hour. So you're getting about 50% of your money back. But it's better than nothing. If you have expert witnesses, you get dollar for dollar for them. If you have other expenses with litigation which arise, you'll get your expenses for litigation. But what do I have to prove? I don't have to just win. That would be too easy. In order to win a fee award, I have to prove that the administrator of the FAA was not substantially justified in pursuing the complaint, bringing the lawsuit, bringing the enforcement action. Well, what does substantially justified mean? That phrase has been argued all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States. What the Supreme Court has said is substantially justified is defined as the FAA must show that the position that they have taken, you violated the regulations, is reasonable to the reasonable person. So I tell people all the time, I ask my 12-year-old daughter, what do you think about this? Is that reasonable? I ask my neighbor, what do you think about that? Is that reasonable? If those people say, you know what, that doesn't make sense, that's the standard, reasonable person standard. Was it reasonable in both fact and law? The facts of this case are my guy had no way to know he was told to stay outside the ATIS. The law, we read it. If I meet all those three hurdles, I've won the reasonable reliance defense. The judge was right. They had no facts and they had no law to reasonably go after my pilot. The case law on this substantial justification is even better, because not only when they issued the initial lawsuit, let's say they had a basis to do it when they did their investigation, but halfway through litigation during discovery, I present all this evidence to the FAA and say, my guy is not culpable for what you're charging him for. Well, at that point, right there and then, the FAA has to reevaluate their case and say, you know what? We do still have basis to continue, or we don't have a basis to continue. And if they decide in the middle of the litigation, and all of a sudden they're confronted with evidence that they don't have a case, but they continue, then I can collect EJIA fees. So this case here, the reason I bring this up, it touches me closely because it just happened to me this last week. I was supposed to be in trial yesterday in New York, and I'll tell you what happened. The moment that the FAA acknowledges that the agency was no longer justified in pursuing the action, the agency's continuation of that action without basis in an effort to coerce, that's the language from the case, coerce the waiver of EJIA fees is a prime example of bad faith. What does that mean? I have this case, it's lasted about a year and a half. The facts may touch home to some of you operating these business jets. I've got a crew of two flying a Challenger aircraft from New Jersey to the Bahamas. They have a Part 135 charter certificate allowing them to operate for nine or less seats. They sell all nine seats, and they've got a pilot and a co-pilot, and they're ready to go to the Bahamas. And the captain says, you know what? I don't want them to make a mess of the owner's airplane. It's a beautiful plane. They're going to be drinking and eating. Let's bring my daughter, who's flown with us before as a cabin aide. You don't need a flight attendant in an aircraft with nine or less seats, only if you have 19 or more. And she'll sit in a jump seat with us. And she'll serve the drinks, and she'll serve the food, and keep the cabin nice and tidy. And we'll show her how to open the door just in case she has to. Well, the FAA finds out about this, and the FAA says, you operated a nine or less operation with 10 passengers on board. Your flight attendant, she's not a flight attendant, was not properly trained or qualified as a flight attendant because you don't have an approved flight attendant training program. So since she wasn't a flight attendant, since she was not trained, she becomes a passenger. And because she was a passenger, you violated your operation specifications, you operated carelessly and recklessly, and by the way, you didn't add her 110-pound weight to the weight of the aircraft, so you were in violation of your load manifest. I looked at this case, and I couldn't believe what was going on here. The FAA has been after this client and has not been able to get any violations since I've been representing them. So I looked at this as another one of those cases. A year and a half goes by. I have a trial scheduled for Wednesday and Thursday of this week. And on Friday of last week, the FAA lawyer calls me and says, well, what if we do this? Okay, what's this? I already made a motion to dismiss, which was pending before the judge. And the lawyer says, if I withdraw the case, will you agree to waive your right to any attorney's fees under the Equal Access to Justice Act? I worked with this FAA lawyer because we were both in law school together when we worked at the FAA. I know where he's coming from. He doesn't have a leg to stand on. He didn't want to respond to my motion to dismiss because I know he couldn't. He had no case to go before the judge. He would have been embarrassed. And he's coercing me and my clients, more importantly, to waive their Equal Access to Justice Act fees. Now, here I am as a trial lawyer saying to my client, we're going to win this case. But I can't risk taking you and my expert witnesses up to New York, having a two-day trial for the chance that the judge is not only going to grant us that we win, but then he's going to find that they weren't substantially justified and give us 50 cents on the dollar? It makes no sense. So, of course, I agreed. And he coerced me to waive the attorney's fees. So something's got to be done about that. If the FAA can bring a case that has no basis and make your client spend a year, year and a half paying money to litigate it, and then they withdraw at the last minute, they should have to pay. So keep that in mind if this ever comes up. Again, aviation law experts, 1-877-4-AIR-LAW. That's what we do. I could turn this off, right? Okay. We'll just talk to you a little bit about enforcement actions in general. The reason why I chose this topic, and it's close to my heart, is I do almost exclusively enforcement litigation. I spent 10 years with the FAA doing it, and I've been doing it for almost 10 years on the outside. Now, I get questions all the time about these things, and a lot of them I say you shouldn't fight them, but I got to tell you, over the last 2 years alone, I've litigated 9 emergency revocation or suspension cases. That's almost unheard of. Most lawyers don't get one in their career. The FAA, for some reason, has been going crazy about issuing these emergency cases. An emergency case, in the nature of the emergency, you have 30 days from the date you get that emergency order of revocation to get before a judge, and the judge renders a decision right from the bench. From that day, you have another 30 days from which a full appeal will be done before the NTSB. The reason they do that is because they realize most professional pilots, if you take them out of the air for 60 days, it's going to have a substantial impact on their livelihood. They get paid to fly. And if the FAA wasn't justified bringing the action, we better get to that answer pretty quickly. So 2 months are lost regardless, even if I win. Okay, so we have to look at these things long and hard and decide, is it worth fighting? Do we have a basis to win? And where do we go with it? Well, the 9 emergency revocation and suspensions I've had, I've won every one of them before the judge except for one. And that was unfortunate. And some of the ones that I even won before the judge were overturned on appeal. So it's like my win was taken away from me. Again, an unfortunate situation. I was just recently appointed as the chairman of the NTSB Bar Association Rules Committee. Now, what we're trying to do there is the NTSB Bar Association are all the lawyers like myself who litigate against the FAA. And the rules of procedure to fight these cases are really one-sided. For instance, the FAA issues a complaint, an order of suspension. I must respond within 5 days, 10 days, 20 days, depending on what it is. If I'm 1 day late, I lose. Interesting. If I file something, the FAA has 5, 10, or 20 days to respond. If the FAA is late, the judge says, there's no prejudice. So what? It's late. Big deal. And they let it continue. Happens all the time. I send out discovery requests. I want to know your witnesses, your evidence, everything. They take their time in responding. Sometimes they show up at a trial. Here you go. We want to introduce this into the record, Your Honor. Ho, ho, ho. I haven't seen that. Counsel, did you give him a copy? No. That's all right. Let him look at it now. A trial. I mean, it's ridiculous. If I try something like that, precluded. You'll never get that evidence in. So to win a case is difficult. You try to settle them anytime you can. But the last 5 cases that I've had are not revocations or suspensions. The FAA has dropped 3, and I've got 2 more pending right now. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens because the quality FAA lawyers has gone down. They don't have any aviation expertise, okay, because almost all are not pilots. And number 3, unfortunately, because of the ADIS that has been created that I explained at the beginning, they are processing more than 2,000 cases a year of inadvertent violations inside the ADIS that is just clogging the entire system. So they don't have enough resources to put together a good case. I mean, I'm getting ADIS cases where the name of the pilot in the notice is the wrong name. They block it, copy it, and send it out. They misidentify aircraft. I got radar data. You're saying this is my client, right? Well, the Cessna 172 is doing 240 knots. Oh, that's not him. But it's got his tail number next to all that radar data. So that's the kind of thing that we're dealing with. So if you ever get yourself in a situation where you get a letter of investigation, the first thing to happen in an enforcement case is what we call a letter of investigation from the FAA. It's an offer for you to present to the FISDO inspector any mitigating circumstances that you may have that's going to help him in his file. Do not respond to the letter of investigation. Most of the cases I get are after my client writes a page and a half to four-page letter explaining everything he did or didn't do or thought he might have done, half of which the FAA didn't know about, and the next time I see that document, it's got an exhibit sticker on it and it's shown to me in front of the judge because that's considered an admission against your interest. 1% of the cases are dropped during the investigation stage. Less than 1%, I should say. So what I do is I respond to the FAA. Thank you for the opportunity to respond to your letter of investigation. Please send me a complete copy of your enforcement investigative file. Once I review it, I will present anything I feel needs to be explained. That's the answer. So if you get anything from today, it's don't respond to the letter of investigation. Okay, you feel like you might have to. The second thing, just as a point of interest, because I know we have a lot of business operators here that operate under Part 91, and my clients fall into this all the time. If you're on a ramp and you're operating a charter operation under Part 135 of the regulations and an FAA inspector comes out to ramp check you, he is entitled to come on board and check all your documents. If it's a Part 91 flight, that gentleman or that woman from the FAA is not entitled to board your aircraft unless you give that person permission. Unless they smell alcohol on your breath, unless they see a visible, unairworthy condition of your aircraft, something hanging off the plane, to ground it, they can do nothing to you if you deny access to them on board the aircraft. There is nothing good that's going to come out of letting an FAA inspector on board your Part 91 aircraft during a Part 91 flight. A lot of people don't know that. Now, we answer our phones 24-hour day, 7 days a week, because we know aviation is not 9 to 5 Monday through Friday. So if you have an aviation lawyer, contact him or her. Contact us. We're always happy to answer your questions. And I'm going to open the floor to the questions now. I will do.
I'm going to start with one question, Greg. One of the things that I'm very curious about is why it is that the FAA may take a year and a half to investigate a Part 135 operator, and then they issue an emergency revocation. If it was really an emergency, why did they wait a year and a half for it? Yeah,
that's a good question. And the NTSB is not have the authority to question the emergency nature that the FAA has decided to take. And that's the first thing every client I have asks me. Hey, Greg, it's a year and a half. Where's the emergency? And generally, you'll get that emergency order of revocation on a Friday of a three-day weekend because the FAA issues it and then they run away for the weekend. Causes the most disruption. There is something new probably since the late 90s a new bill that Congress has put into effect called the Hoover Bill. It was a result of a case with famous air show pilot Bob Hoover where the FAA took emergency revocation of his certificate. And at that point, once the pilot has an emergency revocation, immediately you must stop flying, you must hand in your certificate to the FAA. Well, I was involved, unfortunately, in that Bob Hoover certificate. I took his license away when I was a young FAA lawyer, the last enforcement case I ever did for the FAA. From that, the Hoover Bill now says you have 2 days. Within 2 days of the issuance of an emergency order of revocation, you can challenge by petitioning a review of the FAA's determination of why it's an emergency. Now, the problem with that is the rules for the judge say you must assume all of the allegations that the FAA has made as being true. And if all those allegations are true, without me presenting any evidence, and you still find that there's no qualifications to hold a license, the revocation emergency nature stands. There have been, I think, 3 wins since the Hoover Bill has been enacted. I recently tried a case with a Part 135 operator. Same thing. It was about a year and a half after the operation. The FAA came out with an emergency order of revocation. Now, the big thing now with the FAA is this operational control issue. You don't have operational control over your jets. It all came out of the Challenger that went through the warehouse at the end of Teterboro's runway in New Jersey. And I like to call it the sheep case, okay? Guy had a caravan, Cessna caravan, out of Fort Lauderdale International, and he was contracted by a Bahamian company to ship over 16 pregnant sheep to Long Island in the Bahamas. And the FAA eventually took an emergency order of revocation against the company. I tried the case, and he said, why is it an emergency now? Well, I won the case before the judge. It went on an appeal, and we lost it on the appeal. And now the FAA uses that sheep case as one of their examples in the dog and pony show that they do around the country. With regard to pilots, that's an air carrier revocation. With a pilot certificate, if the FAA doesn't notify you within 6 months of the date of the violation, they cannot suspend your certificate. It's called the six-month stale complaint rule. It's a wonderful thing. I've had several cases thrown out on that. However, of course, there's a way out for the FAA. They always do it. If the FAA alleges lack of qualifications, this gentleman or this woman lacks the qualifications to hold a pilot certificate, I'm going emergency revocation. You could do that after the 6 months. You could do it a year later. So sometimes the FAA, because they missed their six-month statute, will bring an emergency revocation order against my client. I said, why is this an emergency? And then I realized they missed the 6 months. This is the only way they can shoehorn it in, and they try it that way, and we've been able to get those dismissed as well. Doesn't happen very often. Good question.
Anyone other questions else? For Greg? Any enforcement topics or aviation law topics?
In the cases that you brought up after the pilot in command was exonerated, did they then go after the second in command in those instances?
Interesting question. When I looked at the case, by the time I got it, the 6 months have already come and gone. So it was my decision strategically to blame everything on the co-pilot, because I know that the FAA can't do anything about him. And that co-pilot wasn't very willing to do that, to take the responsibility. He felt, I told the captain, he knew. Well, if you told him, why did he fly into the ATIS? So when it came, and remember, the FAA never spoke to this gentleman. I subpoenaed him for trial. He couldn't make it to the trial, which is great. I really didn't want him there. So I took his deposition by telephone, which is one of the hardest things to do. The FAA lawyer was in New York. I'm in Washington, D.C. The witnesses was in Kansas, and my client was somewhere else. And we did this conference call, and the court reporter took it all down, and I introduced that, and the judge read that transcript and said, yeah, he didn't do what he was supposed to do. So, yeah, if the 6 months comes and goes, it's too late to go after the co-pilot.
Other questions?
So they can't do an emergency revocation against the co-pilot?
Well, keep in mind, they could.
Sorry, could you repeat the question?
He asked if they could have done an emergency revocation against the co-pilot. Although the rules of the NTSB say if you miss the 6 months, you can't take a suspension unless it's a revocation, underneath that paragraph says the FAA shall not use revocation as a way of getting around the six-month rule, even though they do it. If they only went after a suspension of the captain, it would be impossible for the FAA with a straight face to argue the first officer should have revocation for the same offense just because they dropped the ball. So that won't necessarily happen.
Other questions? Greg, one more.
Sure. Not really on the subject, but your comments on the midair for the Embraer and the airliner in Brazil that's kind of taken over the news and stuff lately?
What about it? What do you want to know about it?
Is there any basis of law that the Brazilians hold that could actually bring justice against the pilots?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't personally know enough about South American law to comment on whether or not they have basis to do that. However, there has been a fear on the part of the aviation lawyers in the United States that any type of civil certificate action against a pilot can be used as criminal action as well. Sometimes it is, and there's not a fine distinction right now. I'll tell you where it happens. In California recently, the Department of, I guess, Social Services, believe it or not, went out and said to the FAA, you know what, give us the names of all the pilot applicants that applied for medical certificates in the state of California. And it might have been only within a certain city limit or a few city limits. Then they said to the, I guess it was social services, give us the names of all these pilots who have claimed disability insurance benefits under workers' compensation. And they looked at the two and they said, wait a minute, this guy's claiming that he's disabled and he's collecting a check, but when he goes for his medical, he doesn't say anything about it. Now, if you don't declare or disclose on your medical application that you're taking medication or seeking some type of medical treatment, that's falsification. And falsification is grounds for revocation of all of your licenses, not only your medical, but all of your pilot certificates. Then, to really kick you in the ass, they go to the U.S. attorney, if they really want to be vindictive, and they say, do me a favor. When you sign the bottom of that certificate application for your airman medical, it says any false statements are subject to penalties of perjury under 49 U.S.C. 1001, which is a criminal statute. Making a false statement intentionally to the United States government has criminal implications. So these guys, not only did they lose their benefits and lose their pilot certificates, they are prosecuted criminally. So in that case, yes, operationally, so far, no. A pilot has violated an operational regulation other than flying drunk, I should say, has not been criminally prosecuted.
Greg, my understanding, I think that was called Operation Sunshine. My understanding is that the FAA is planning to do that nationwide now.
They probably will. When I was, a new young aviation lawyer at the FAA in New York, I was in charge of what they called the IG Match program. And what they did there was went to the Inspector General of the Department of Transportation and said, give us all of your pilot names. And they ran a check against the NCIC, which is National Criminal something or other. It's a criminal database. And they said, okay, we have people from felonies of robbery to child molestation. Some of these guys were ATPs. Well, that not only goes against, first of all, they never declared it on their medical or pilot application, so that's falsification. But ATP, you're required to have good moral character. So they were prosecuting these guys for bad moral character of having some of these felony violations. So that Inspector IG Match program, I think, netted about 6,000 cases, and I was personally in charge of running those through probably for about a three-year period. So if the FAA is going to start doing that and the sunshine that they referred to in California and bring it nationally, we're going to have a lot more of these cases where they're going to go after people criminally. But what you're referring to is if a pilot does something operationally in the air, that can be considered a crime, because right now the certificate action or the civil penalty action is considered a civil action. It's not criminal. I want to mention one more thing. In some of the cases that I have now, the FAA goes after, they're getting smarter, the pilot and the co-pilot on a certificate action. In the same note, they go after the owner-operator of the airplane for a civil penalty action because they're responsible as the operator for the violations of the pilots. Now, the interesting thing is a certificate action against the pilots goes before the National Transportation Safety Board that I explained to you, okay? The civil penalty action goes before the Department of Transportation. It's a different administrative law judge. So me, when I get the cases and I go, which judge do I like better? Then I try to get one case heard before the other. Because if I win one case, then I could say, you don't get a second chance to try this case if you lost the first time. And sometimes I'm better off on the civil penalty action. Now, the problem with civil penalty is the appeal process. The FAA brings the case against your operator. They want a $33,000 civil penalty for violating the regulations. If I don't like that, I go to the administrative law judge. He renders a decision, $33,000. Then I get to appeal that. You know who decides the appeal? The administrator of the FAA. So the administrator was the one who started the case to begin with. I go before a law judge. I don't like the law judge's decision. Goes right back to the administrator to make a decision as to whether or not the case was proper to begin with. It's an awful appellate procedure. We've argued it before the Supreme Court, and we've been told, no, it's proper. The administrator keeps herself isolated until she gets to that appeal, and so it's a no-win situation. So it's a very sticky situation. A lot of people will use their in-house corporate attorneys to try to handle some of these things. Unless you know the rules and work with them on a daily basis, you can really get caught up. One procedural flaw, one missed filing of a deadline, and you can really subject your pilots and your air carrier to quite extensive fees and fines and penalties. So keep that in mind if anything ever arises.
Greg, thank you very much. And for those in the audience, thank you for your questions and engagement. There is a reception over in the other hangar with the exhibit, so I encourage you to go over and enjoy more conversation and networking at the reception.
Great. Thanks. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity. Get something out of it.